is the start of tape number two. I'm leaving several feet of tape on this end first. Because
there is a correction to be made. The distance from Bettles to Canyon Creek is 65 miles. It is stated in the reel further on that it was 15 miles. This is incorrect. Grace, you be sure and change that to 65 miles. This is now the start of the story on reel number two. An old timer and prospector from Canyon Creek on John River, a tributary to the Kaizer River, by the name of Bill McCammoth, had spent the winter in the Portland area. Being a good promoter and full of bull, he was able to interest a couple of Portland businessmen to finance a mining venture on his property on Canyon Creek. The plan was for the party to buy a boat and start from the Nana, proceed downriver to Keokuk Station, and then up the Keokuk River to Bettles, and up John River to Canyon Creek. They needed quite a big boat, as they were shipping a large outfit from the States. I guess Bill had in mind a grub stake for several years. Bill was at the time, my guess, 80 years old at least. While the only boat available and for sale was a gas boat, I just named the Tanana, owned by the Energy Company. The boat was located at the village of Tanana. This boat was formerly used by the Norton Commercial Company to carry mail and also for pushing a small barge supplying some of the stores. But due to the fact that it had a draft of 4 feet, way too much for the often low water in the Tanana River, and also being a tremendous gas eater, they had decided to dispose of it should some gullible buyer come along. Bill McCann's party, in dire need of some mode of transportation for their mining outfit, bought the monster for an undisclosed price. The deal was made in Seattle, and as the boat could not carry enough gasoline for the trip to the destination, let alone any groceries and other supplies, it was decided to ship up a marine boiler and an upright steam engine, as wood could be bought from wood camps along the Tanana. And their plans were to cut their own wood should it be necessary. Traveling up the Keokuk and the John River, they also purchased a small barge for the purpose of carrying the wood and some of their supplies. Have a picture to show the outfit. Arriving at Nenana, the party engaged Fred Clark as river pilot and proceeded down to Tanana to pick up the boat. Bring the tub to Nenana and install the boiler and the steam engine. This is where the plans of us boys changed. On the way up the river, the boat stopped at Manly Hot Springs. By then, having worked hard getting the boat off several sandbars, the businessmen from Portland had decided that they were not in the best of shape for the kind of task a they had to perform. Therefore, could use a couple of young men for the heavier duties. Dan Greens mentioned to them that there was two young fellows staying at his roadhouse that had mentioned a desire to come someday prospect in the Keokuk district. They contacted us, and of course, we were tickled to death to join the group. The agreement was that Ari and I would help getting the boat to Nenana, help with the remodeling, installing the steam car, then work for our transportation of ourselves and the outfit as far as Bettles on the Keokuk. To us, this agreement was fine, and we moved our few belongings on board. Soon after leaving Hot Springs, I could hear a lot of bickering and argument among the Portland outfit, and I mentioned to Ira that if they were already starting to fight before actually getting started, it would be a real battle before reaching their destination. There was a man and his wife. She was to be the cook on the trip, and two other businessmen from Portland. After being stuck on several sandbars, one could soon realize what a misfit the boat really was. But we finally arrived at Nenana. After putting the boat in some dry, semi-dry dock, we started to install the equipment. Scraped the hull after a fashion and applied a coat of paint. By now there was open hostility amongst the Portland mining people. The man and his wife pulled out and left the country, and one of the businessmen all at once had urgent business in the state. This left Fred Clark, Ira, and myself, and one of the original backers to carry on. This man, by the name of Herb Byron, was a mining engineer and a hard worker. After spending the greater part of a month at Nenana, we had the outfit ready. While in Nenana, Ira and I had promised Herb Byron that we would stay with Bill McCammon on Canyon Creek and do some prospecting during the winter. It wouldn't cost us anything as the company had lots of groceries, and Herb Byron had to return to Portland where he had a business. So we told him that we would do so. Of course, we have never met Bill McCammon, so we didn't know what kind of a person he was, but we thought that he wouldn't be, have to be pretty bad if he couldn't get along with him. And we found out later on that he was a nice fellow to get along with and a wonderful cook. He was about the best cook that I ever seen in that part of the country. Well, getting the outfit ready at Nenana for departure, we decided to load the boat heavier than the bow, as to keep the draft off the stern as much as possible. Then we loaded some of the freight and some of the wood on the barge and started down the river. The water had dropped a lot since our trip upriver, and the town of Nenana was still in sight when we struck on the first sandbar. This occurred quite often until we reached the Yukon River. I had never seen a small boiler consuming as much wood as the one we had on board. I was elected fireman, and it seemed like he was always poking wood in the boiler. Fred was the pilot, and I was the deckhand and woodcutter, and Fred Byron was to do the cooking and other chores whenever necessary. The boiler would not take 4 foot wood, so the regular cordwood had to be cut in two. Later on the Keokuk River, for the good enough plywood, we would cut a tree down and cut it in as long a length as we could handle. Then do the final cutting on the barge, where we had a sawhorse set up. The Yukon River trip was not bad as far as sandbars were concerned. We made a stop at Ruby. From there, our next stop was Kaikuk Station. At the mouth of the Kaikuk River, the river entered into the Yukon, and it was quite shallow. After we got up in the river anyway, it was not bad at all. Starting up the Kaikuk River proper, and after getting up quite a ways is where our fun began, or I should say our hard work started. There is no wood camps along the river, so we had to stop often to cut wood. The mosquitoes were like black clouds around our heads whenever we stopped. When traveling, there was enough breeze from the motion of the boat to keep most of them away. We tied up at night as there was only enough crew on board for one long shift. We had to sleep under bed nets and at all times. There were 4 bunks on board. I can't imagine what we would have done if the party had not split up at Nenana, especially with a woman passenger and no privacy. The lower part of the Kaikuk River, as far as used, is fairly deep and not to swift the current. It was more or less the case of crossing from one cut bank to the next. We made fairly good time with the old tub, and when I was not busy cutting wood or doing some other chores, I would take a turn at the wheel, spelling off red cards. From here on, the river is swifter and shallower. In places, we no sooner freed ourselves from one sandbar before being stuck on another. There is one place on the lower river before reaching Hughes where there is a cutoff. In good water, by taking this cutoff, one can save several miles of travel. We took this cutoff. To our sorrow, we were stuck for 3 days on a bar. Finally had to ground sluice our way through the riffle. There was many sweepers leaning out from the riverbank in places, and in order for the sweepers clearing the pilot house on the boat, we would stand forward with a sharp axe and make a cut in the sweeper so it would break when hitting the pilot house. One day we approached a long slender sweeper. Her Byron grabbed the axe and stood ready for the approaching offender. When, as he thought, he had the right aim, he swung the axe with a mighty swing. Missed the sweeper, lost his balance, and went head first in the river. Lucky I was on the stern of the boat and was able to grab him before he went by. I pulled him on board. The first thing Herb said, "Look, I still have the axe." And sure enough, so he did. I think he would have drowned before giving up the only axe we had with us.
That's the end of my notes for now.
Between Hughes and the village of Alakakis, we broke the propeller shaft on the boat. Using a Spanish windlass made from some rope and a couple of poles, we were able to drag the stern of the boat onto a sandbar or into water shallow enough to work on the repairs. The shaft broke inside the boat and we could not work on it unless we pulled the broken part off to the stern. We had to go through the stern bearing. Luckily, we had one universal joint the size of the shaft with us. Our supply of machine tools were limited to a few wrenches, hammers, hacksaw, wood brace, and an assortment of small drills. In order to install the universal joint, we first had to drill the shaft on both sides of the brace in order to pin the universal joint to the shaft. With only a carpenter's brace to accomplish this job, it took us a couple of days drilling, but we finally made it. Sometimes drilling was going so slow that one man would sit on the other fellow's back in order to get more pressure on the brace. After completing the job, we went fishing. I never saw such thrilling fishing. My first in Alaska. Every cast was a fish. We fished in a small creek flowing into the main river. We had all the fish we could possibly use in about 20 minutes. One day after passing the village of Ellicacket, Bert Clark motioned for me to come up in the pilot house, pointing his finger inland to a small knoll. He said, "There is 4 mountain sheep." He said it was unusual for sheep being this far from the mountains and so close to the river. As we had been living on bacon, ham, and fish for a long time, our mouths watered at the thought of fresh, juicy mountain sheep meat. We tied up the boat to some trees, and Fred, Ira, and I started sneaking up on the game. We did not know then that the sheep had gone over the knoll. When we got close to where the sheep were supposed to be, they were not in sight. Standing for a few minutes deciding what to do next, there was a slight noise in our right, or onto our right, and here the 4 sheep were standing looking at us, not 200 feet from us. We all started shooting at once, but book fever had taken over on all of us. Was doggone shaky, we couldn't hold the gun still, and I guess we never came close to hitting our target. The sheep just turned around and trotted away. Last time we saw them, they were going over the next hill. We returned to the boat with empty guns and empty bags. Whenever someone mentioned this hunt later, he was told in plain English to shut up and leave the subject closed. We were also ashamed of our marksmanship. President Clark had made several trips on the Kiakuk previous and knew the river quite well, but every breakup changes the channels of the river. So even with his experience, we were having lots of trouble, including in the outfit purchased in the state with an Evinrude outboard motor, year of manufacture unknown. It was, I guess, early 20s, and about 3 horsepower, using a hotshot battery for ignition or booster for the mag. In my spare time after leaving Nenana, I would try every day to start this motor. I would turn the flywheel crank by the hour. Finally, one day it started, scaring me half to death. We also had with us a small rowboat, or a coaling boat, as it is called most of the time. Being stuck on the sandbar again, one day, Fred said, "We can't be over 10 or 12 miles from Bethel. How about taking the coaling boat and outboard and make a trip up to the town? We need some gear that we can borrow or buy there." We all agreed it was a good idea. Ira would stay with the boat and having worked on the motor, I was elected to run the Little Darling. We started out the next morning, dragging the boat over the ripples and making it about 3 miles per hour in between. We finally arrived at Bettles that evening. I don't think there was 3 other men in Alaska as wet and tired and hungry as we were. At Bettles, we were greeted by the entire population, including kids and dogs. The population of Bettles was probably 25 or 30 people at that time. They told us that they heard our putt-putt motor hours away. I have no doubt about that, as we were traveling for the slow. We checked in at Jack Dodd's Roadhouse, the only place in Bettles to stay. The next morning, we went to the general store owned by Sam Dubin. The store was run by a fellow named Bill English, a real nice boss. We made a purchase of some needed supplies. There were several items we were short in our grub down on the boat. The store was well stocked with the usual trading post staples and groceries, but of course much higher in price than we were used to. But considering the problem and cost of freighting the freight into Bettles, it could have been a lot worse. After visiting with English for a while, we departed down the river. The trip down river took only a short time compared with going up. The trip to Bettles paid off, as we had gained a lot of knowledge of the river channel, and it made it a lot easier bringing the monster up to Bettles. We spent the next day floating the Tanana off the gravel bar, and a couple of days later, tied up in front of Sam Dubin's store at Bettles. The John River enters into the Kiakuk River about a mile above Bettles. We were told by the old timers that it was impossible to navigate this river with the Tanana. In some places the river was narrow and so swift that even a poling boat had to be lined through the ripples. This information brought our previous plans to abrupt halt. It so happened that Jack White, the freighter between Bettles and Weissman, was in town after a load of freight. Jack freighted with a large scow powered with a gas engine. He also carried 2 horses on the scow, and in shallow water, the horses pulled the scow through the ripples, and in deep water, the horses rode on the scow. He offered us the use of a large gas-driven boat. The engine was a usual timer, and at one glance, one could tell it was a real gas consumer. Having no alternate, we were glad to accept his offer. Having tons of supplies, we knew that a large portion had to be left behind. Herb Byram sold a lot of stuff to the Dubin store. We also stored part of the outfit in Bettles, to be picked up at a later date. In Bettles, we ran into a fellow by the name of Otto William Geist, later well known in his work at the University of Alaska in the field of anthropology. Geist had been prospecting on the Wild River, a tributary to the Kiakuk, and also on the upper reaches of the John River. So he was well acquainted with the river. Otto offered his services free of charge to act as our guide during the 15 miles journey up to Canyon Creek. Of course, an extra man in the boat meant less freight, so we did not accept his offer. But I was a great help in getting the gas engine started and in shape for the trip. We loaded on as much gasoline as we estimated it would take for the trip, what we figured would be about 3 days trip, ran into 6 days before reaching Camp Canyon Creek. We had burned all our gas, mixing kerosene with gas. We burned all our supplies for the gas lamp. That is the white gas. This left nothing for the return trip to Bellows later. But the river was swift most of the way, but Clark said they could drift without the use of the engine and reach Bellows all right. After lining the boat in places and at times unloading and packing some of the freight up to the head of the ripples, we finally arrived at the mouth of Canyon Creek. There was a 10 by 12 cabin at the place where we landed. It was in good shape. We also had a 10 by 12 tent that we pitched. And as it started to rain, we set right to work getting our outfit under cover. See pictures of the landing and the cabin. The camera was occupying the cabin when we landed. Nat had been waiting for several weeks for the party to arrive. He seemed like a nice old Scotsman, and I knew from the start that we would get along all right. Mac told us that his mining claims were located 3 miles up the creek. The trails of the mines were located on the hillside above the creek bottom, the bottom itself being full of boulders, and the creek curving back and forth. There were several shortcuts, and this made the distance a lot shorter. Mac had told us that several years prior, himself and two other men had built a nice 12 by 16 cabin on the claim. Also sank a 65 or 70 foot deep shaft. They had found some pay, but he said the shaft was not in the main channel, and he felt that the main pay street could be found by sinking another shaft on the claim. According to Bill McCammon, the reason for the other two men leaving the claim, he said, was they were short of grub and one of the men not feeling the good. He intended to return and sink another shaft, but for some unknown reason, this never did happen. The next morning, we made up a pack, and with Mac in the lead for showing the trail, we started for the mining claim. Arriving at the cabin early in the afternoon, we all had heavy packs and had to travel slow. We found the cabin in good shape except for the cook stove being very poor. We had brought a small Lang cook stove from Nenana, and it was now down at the lower cabin, or at the landing. I was elected to go down the trail, the landing, and bring up the new stove. It took me a long time to make the trip. Not that the weight was so great, but it was so darn miserable and awkward to carry. I had it on my back, on my shoulders, even on my head, but it didn't seem to fit any place. I set it down, I think, 1,000 times to rest. But I finally made it back to the cabin late in the evening. Mac had a big supper waiting, and after eating and resting a while, I was ready to make another trip, should I have to. Before the former prospector left Mac to seal up the shaft he had been sinking, this was done by putting in a collar 8 foot down from the surface. Spruce poles were then laid across, tied together, and then a layer of moss and dirt about a foot thick covered the poles. This was also repeated at the top of the shaft. As the shaft was in permafrost, these seals would keep the muck and gravel from thawing and keep the shaft from sloughing. While all this work had been performed on the old shaft, no one knew. Jack did not say, or Mac, brother, did not say. Some months later, but it was then too late for me to do anything about it. I think I had the answer. I believe he had found good pay in the bottom of the shaft, but for some unknown reason, did not even let Mac in on it. My idea was that the boys planned to return at some later date, or maybe promote a sale on their findings. Unbeknownst to Mac and the rest of the party, I took several pans on the dump from the gravel from the bottom of the shaft, and I had some real good pans. The mining equipment on the claim consisted of a boiler, a steam hoist, and a self-dumping bucket, complete with cables and carriage. The boiler and hoist were located in a small boiler house close to the sealed-off shaft, having been used for sinking for this particular pole. The pole for the self-dumping outfit had been taken down, or else it fell on its own accord. The first thing Herb Byron wanted to do was to uncover the old shaft, as he wanted to go down and inspect the old workings. Mac had told him that they had made a short drift at the bottom of the shaft when they hit bedrock. First they removed the top covering, then they moved down to the steel at 8 foot level. We picked all the dirt and moss loose, and having built a tripod on top, hoisted all the material out of the hole with the steam hoist. Fred Clark was operating the hoist. We took turns picking the muck and mucking. I was alone in the shaft when we started removing the poles. Having removed about half of the poles, I felt kind of funny in the head. But I thought maybe I was getting a little scared standing on the slender poles with the black hole beneath my feet. I hollered to one of the boys who dropped me the end of the rope. I wanted this in case I could slip on the icy poles. When I sent the rope down, I tied it under my arms. I continued working until all the poles were removed except two. These two poles I was standing on. We agreed that those two poles would not interfere with the hoisting of the bucket, and I returned to the top. When I got up in the fresh air, I felt kind of light in the head. I blamed this on the rotten smell in the shaft. I said nothing to the boys. I was afraid that the boys would think that I was scared. and I chickened out. I realized a little later that I should have mentioned my guilty feelings that the near tragedy took place an hour later. In removing the debris from the 8-foot level of the steel, we have been using a small bucket, a regular windlass bucket, in place of the large self-dumping bucket. We did this in order to have more room to work, and it was also easier to dump my hand when it came up to the top, because it was light. The bucket we used was about 20 inches square, with a loop running from each corner. Byron decided he would go below and take a look. Standing in the bucket and holding onto the cable, when Crack was running the hoist and I was at the cotter of the shaft, Bert started down holding a candle in one hand. When his hand holding the candle came even with the lower collar where the steel had just been removed, the candle went out. I hollered, "Bert, your candle went out." Right then, he hollered, "Hoist me up, hoist me up." I turned it around and facing Fred for a second, ordered hoist. When I turned to the shaft again, Herb was hanging head down, his feet caught in the bucket. The roof had caught his feet, and I thought for sure he would drop any time. The voice started, and luckily his feet did not slip out of the roof. I grabbed him as soon as I could reach him. Herb came to in a few minutes after getting some fresh air. He explained that he could feel himself losing consciousness, but he did not remember falling backwards. We checked the shaft right after Herb came to by lowering a lighted candle. We also lowered a bucket with some lighted oil rags, and as soon as the light came even with the 8-foot collar, it went out. The shaft being closed and sealed for some time, it was airtight. Black damp gas had accumulated in the shaft. Being a mining engineer, Herb Byram should have checked this before going down. Despite his narrow escape, Byron was still determined to see the bottom of the hole. But first we had to remove the gas. We ran a pipe from the boiler and down the shaft, then by steaming for 2 days, we finally could lower a candle clear to the bottom without it going out. We now changed to the bigger bucket. It was large enough for Byron to fit in, and in this fashion, he went down the second time. This time he also had 2 candles lit. After landing at the bottom, Byron never moved out of the bucket, and no one blamed him for that. It took a lot of nerve for a man to go down into a place the second time where he nearly missed death a couple of days before. There was nothing gained from his observations at the bottom of this old shaft and the location for sinking a new shaft was for the following winter was determined and agreed upon. And as the summer was nearly gone, Byron decided that he and Fred Clark would depart for Bethel, pick up the Tamanaw, and try to make it up to Nenana before freeze up. I heard later that other guys went along to help. And that they made it as far as Panama before freezing in. There the boat was pulled out, and I assume that it's still there. As far as I'm concerned, it is better off on land than in water. Soon after Byron and Clark left, Mac, Ira, and I started making plans for the coming winter. The first thing we did was to pack up all our supplies from the cabin at the landing to our main cabin at the mine, where we were to spend the winter. This took a good many trips of back-breaking packing. Mac McCammon had four dogs, but as there was no snow as yet, we could not use the sled. We made pack sacks for the dogs. It would pack 20-25 pounds with ease, but sometimes they became entangled in some willows, and as they were loose, sometimes left the trail, and we would have to go and look for them, pack and all. After moving the supplies, it was decided for Ira and I to take the poling boat and the outboard and make a trip to Bell's. After some needed supplies, we needed some kerosene for the lamp, also some gas for the blowtorch, and several other items that we had forgotten before we left Bell's. We had to drift downstream as we had no gasoline to run the motor, having used all our gasoline on the trip going upstream. We made the trip to Bell's without any trouble, drifting, for the river was swift, and rowing in between the ripples where there was very little current. The next day we loaded our freight in the boat. We planned on leaving early in the morning. I put the outboard motor on the stern of the boat, and we thought we better try to start the motor as it had been idle for some time and may be hard to start. Checking, we found that the hotshot battery was dead. Lucky we were able to buy one at the Dublin store. We finally got the antique thing running. The following morning, bright and early, found us on our way. Our progress was slow, but finally we made it up to the Timberfoot cabin, 18 miles from Bettles. We decided to spend the night in the cabin, as the weather was starting to turn cold, especially at night. The next morning, when we tried to start the motor, we found that the propeller had fallen off. We must have lost the nut holding the propeller onto the shaft someplace down the river the day before, but as long as the propeller was pushing the boat, it stayed on the shaft. But as soon as we stopped the motor at the cabin, it fell off the shaft. We tried every way to imagine, searching in order to try to find the darn prop. I even dove down in the icy cold water to no avail. Being a strong current and deep water where we had tied the boat, the prop probably drifted downstream some distance before sinking. After some discussion, pro and con, we decided to unload the boat, put the freight in the cabin, and return to Bettles, and take a chance on obtaining a prop there. As we were only 18 miles up John River and coming back with an empty boat, we would not lose much time should we not find a prop in Bettles. Even as unpredictable as the old motor was, it was a great help between the ripples and gave us a few minutes to rest. We found a number of old propellers and bevels, but only one with the same shaft size as our motor. And it was the wrong pitch. In other words, we would have to run the motor in reverse in order to use it. On the early models, Evinrude outboard, when in reverse, the lower unit of the motor swings around, and in other words, the propeller is ahead of the motor or under the boat. Well, we tried it, but the blades were too long. With a hacksaw, we cut the two blades, or cut a piece off each blade, and with a file, sharpened and balanced the propeller as best as we could. We then tried it. The motor turned it all right, but a little slow, and there was a lot of vibration. Well, it was the best bevels had to offer, so we had to take it. We started out, made several miles, favoring the motor as much as possible. But as we progressed, new and additional noises developed. The vibration also increased rapidly. Then finally, about a mile from the Timber Creek cabin, a noise like a shot sounded. Then one noise like the last gasp of life, and all was quiet on Down River. Harry and I looked at each other, as much as to say, well, that's that. That's the end of the motor. The little darling given up. I suggested that we give it a final and fitting burial place in the deepest hole we could find in the river. After debating for a few minutes, we decided to leave it in the old cabin, and it may still be there if the cabin is or in its ruins. The next morning, we loaded our boat again. We knew that from now on it was a case of poling and lining the boat all the way to Canyon Creek. Ira and I, having mastered the art of poling, also the trick of lining the boat using a bridle. When lining with a bridle, we could both pull the boat. The bow line of the bridle being longer kept the bow of the boat away from the bank or the sandbar without anybody in the boat. We put in a long day and made about 20 miles, and at this rate should arrive at Canyon Creek 2 or 3 more days. We made camp on a sandbar each night, and as we did not have a tent, kept the fire going all night. We were glad to start out early in the morning to get warm again. We had bought a case of sweet potatoes and bettles, and as we did not take time to do much cooking, we had a can each meal. After the trip was over and for the rest of the winter, neither one of us could stand the sight of sweet potatoes, nor the smell of them cooking. When making camp each night, we always brought our rifles from the boat and leaned them against a tree or a willow, in case a bear should come snooping around. We saw fresh tracks on the sandbars every day. The season was advancing towards winter, and we could use the moose. It was freezing hard at night, and we thought the meat would keep. In breaking camp one morning, I forgot my 32 carbines. I did not discover the loss until we camped for the night. As I had another rifle at the camp, the loss was not too serious. We had in mind going down to Battles with the dog team sometime during the winter to check our mail and buy some things that we may be short. We both felt that we could find all our camping spots, even with the snow on the ground, as each camp was marked with at least 2 empty sweet potato cans hanging on willows. Fresh ice was now forming on the river, and the boat was frozen throws in every morning. We finally made it to the landing at Canyon Creek. And if anyone ever rejoiced at the sight of a cabin, it was us. Mac had stayed at the lower cabin while we were gone, and the dogs told him we were coming long before our arrival. In fact, long enough for him to prepare a big meal, and as I mentioned before, Mac was about the best cook I have ever met in Alaska, and I think that at the time, Mac was feeding two of the hungriest river tramps in the territory.